The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Oh, such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Shop up to 45% off select styles, plus a free professional measure and a 100% satisfaction guarantee during the Blinds.com year-end blowout. Up to 45% off now at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
All right, here we go. 9:10 on the final Friday of 2024. I took a trip to North Louisiana recently. I was talking about that. I've spoken a lot about it. And while I was driving, Google Maps routed me through Arkansas, which is not between here and Ruston, Louisiana. But it happened, and I was on a lot of back roads, and I don't know what would have happened if I had had an EV. So I thought we'd have, and also on the interstates, I didn't see a lot of charging stations. So I thought we'd talk with Stephen Melnick, our friend, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research in strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements, and supply chain design. Good morning, professor. How are you?
Good morning, and not bad. How about yourself? I hope you had a good Christmas.
I did, sir, and I hope you have you did as well, and I hope you have a happy New Year. So I was also at a holiday gathering, heard a discussion, a heated discussion about electric vehicles, and then I saw the story about maybe Honda and Nissan merging, perhaps because they were a little bit behind in the EV business. Tell me about all of that.
Okay, what you've got going on, last week I think it was, Honda and Nissan announced their intentions to merge operations, and this is supposed to be completed by about 2026. And in looking at it, you have to understand what happened. In the United States, Nissan has been in the free fall. Sales have been down dramatically. This year, I taught an executive MBA class, and some of my students were managers in Nissan, and they were concerned about their jobs. Mm. So for Nissan, they had a situation where their quality was down, sales were down, and there was just a concern about their future longevity. On the other hand, Honda has a problem. It has two problems. Number one, they don't have much representation in the truck market. Nissan does. Mm-hmm. And number two, they have to deal with the fact that the market has changed. And they need resources in order to do R&D, to improve production, and in order to develop electrification. And in this area, Nissan has a bit of a head start because they developed one of the first fully electric cars, the Leaf. So you've got a situation on one hand where Nissan and Honda have to get together because they're dealing in a new marketplace. And on the other hand, China is there. And China has been a problem for not only Nissan and Honda, but for the other car companies. Sales of companies like Volkswagen in China are down by 30%. GM, which used to depend upon China as a sales area, as a, an area where they could make sales, is also experiencing pushback. And on the other hand, guess what? Guess who now is the number one exporter of vehicles in the world? Give me two guesses. First one, China.
Man.
And that's because, and what they're doing is they're coming into the market, and especially in electrification, they have a really significant advantage, head start. I've read some reviews of the Chinese cars which have been introduced to the United States. And guess what? Low-priced, high-quality, innovative. And they're going to pose a problem. Right now, the price of a typical EV in the United States is around 52 to 55,000. Mm-hmm. The Chinese are coming in about 35,000.
But what about the tariffs and even, that are proposed?
That's going to increase things. But on the other hand, guess what? China also has, BYD has a vehicle called, I think it's a Sea Dragon or Dragon, and it has an MSRP of $10,000. So double that. Here's a question. How many of your viewers, listeners, would be interested in having access to a car with about a 400-mile range, which is well-built, and about $35,000.
Well, hang on one second. Let me open an Oakenhart Jeweler talk and text line here. I meant to do this before, but I forgot to get the audience involved. 504-260-1870, if you have any questions or comments about EVs or what the professor just asked you. So you're talking about this. What's the name of the Chinese car?
It's called, I think it's called the Dragon or Sea Dragon. I can get it up in a minute, but
that's all right. What it 400-mile range. That's what you're saying?
I'll give you some idea. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll give you some of the vehicles that are comparable to what we have in the States. You have the Jinping G6, all-wheel drive, 480 horsepower, 87.6 kilowatt hours, a range of 434 miles. Which is in excess of many of the cars EVs we're listening to, with the MSRP of $32,317. And this is not bare bone. This has some really neat features. You've got these, I can't pronounce it, ZEEKRX. It's an all-wheel drive, 422 horsepower, 69 kilowatt, 310 miles, $30,692. Or a luxury brand, the Avatar 12 all-wheel drive. How about this? 569 horsepower, 94.5 wow. kilowatt hours, 403 mile range, $55,000.
Now that's $55,000 pre-tariff?
Pre-tariff.
Okay, so the
that's
tariff.
That's competitive.
But what's the U.S. government going to do and the U.S. auto industry going to do as far as tariffs, Trump administration, et cetera? Is that just pie in the sky, or are you going to be looking to double those prices or what?
That's a good question. The Chinese government has signaled that if Trump goes in with a tariff policy, they're going to restrict sales of technology and the raw ingredients that we need to make batteries. Guess what? You've got an interesting situation, which is the Chinese government has invested heavily in the auto industry in China. They brought it up. They're ready to compete internationally. And if Trump wants to compete, this is going to be an interesting situation of tit for tat. And I'm going to be interested to see how this plays out because from the Chinese perspective, they see Europe and they see North America as really prime areas for their vehicles. And what they're doing is they're doing what Henry Ford did in the auto industry. They're coming in at the low end, offering products which are full-featured, well-built, with a low price. And so, you know, and if you put tariffs in place, well, it's very simple. You need rare earth materials. Guess what? You ain't going to get them from us. You need batteries. Ain't going to get them from us. So it's going to be an interesting situation to see how this tariff game plays because it's not, you're not playing with a small government. You're playing with China. And China views this as a significant area of their strategy. They have played the long game beautifully. They have learned from Europe. They've learned from America. They've learned about manufacturing. They've understood the importance of the fact that they're really the first movers. They're the ones, if you look at the reputation that they have in terms of EVs, innovative, well-built features. Like, for example, one of these vehicles, the ZEKRX, it has two LCD screens in it, one which replicates the driver's controls, and another one which can be moved back and forth across the front dash so that the passenger can use it. And if you look at, compare that to the Tesla, you've only got a mid, you've got an LCD screen or a computer screen in the middle that can't be moved. So what you've got going on is you've got China, which is, they see this as important. And so getting back to the question you asked, why did Honda and Nissan merge? They need to pool resources because they're behind the eight ball in terms of progress and electrification, and they're competing with China.
I'm so looking at, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so therefore, how do you survive in this market? And what they've just done is, with the merger, they have become the third largest car company in the world.
Honda and Nissan have?
Yes, right behind. Toyota number one, Volkswagen number two. And Volkswagen, by the way, is suffering some really serious problems at home because they've had their problems with electrification, and on top of that, with the law, with the reduction of sales to China, they're looking at closing plants in Germany, and this has really generated a lot of political tension, where people don't want plants and workforce life, in essence, their livelihood to be threatened. They're talking about closing 1 to 3 plants out of the 12. I think it's 10 plants that they now run in Germany. So it's a dynamic, it's a really changing landscape.
I only have about 1,000 questions for you, so let's take a break, and then I'll come back and ask them to you. I want to talk about the leverage that China does have against tariffs. You can put on your supply chain hat for that. I'm looking at the Avatar right now. It's a good-looking vehicle from the Avatar 6, 7, 11, 12, 011 or 012. Also about compare and contrast this to when Datsuns, as they were known then, and Toyotas first came in to compete with the American auto market, and are there comparisons to be made there? A lot of questions I have. Y'all have any 504-260-1870? We're just talking about the marketplace, not the electric vehicles themselves. Hopefully we'll have time to get there. We're talking to our friend, Professor Steve Melnick. He is our EV go-to guy, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements, and supply chain design. If you can safely, go online and Google avatr.com and see if you'd buy one of these things from China. Of course, you got to have it fixed, right? You got to have a place to have it fixed when it breaks, because it's a machine and it will break. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. It is currently not
presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
I'm Anna Garcia with True Crime News, the podcast. Every crime tells a story. Every story demands justice. True Crime News, the podcast, covers breaking crimes, investigating high-profile and under-the-radar cases. Every week, we dive beyond the headlines, exploring the effects of violent crimes on victims and search for justice. We hope you join us as your weekly source for true crime news. Listen to and follow True Crime News, the podcast, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 27, we're talking about China and the auto industry with our friend Stephen Melnick. He's a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. So, Professor, you know, you talked about China playing the long game, and they really are here. And let's go back to your supply chain hat and talk about leverage that China would have against tariffs and keeping, what could they keep from America that we need, and how could that hurt us?
All right. How about the following? Take a look at the top five U.S. imports in China. Smartphones. About 70, almost 80% of our smartphones come from China. How about portable computers? Close to 80%. How about lithium batteries? Here's an interesting area. What do EV cars have to use if they're going to run? Lithium batteries. Guess where they come from? 70% come from China. And guess what? That percentage has increased from the last time Trump from 2018. How about toys? Approximately close to about 75% come from China. Video game consoles, 85% come from China. Now, that's directly from China. And then you've got a little bit of an interesting game China plays. And I've had some of my research friends tell me about this game. And that is, what they'll do is they'll set up companies in other countries, ship the product to there, and then have the product then shipped to the United States or to Europe. Guess where they're doing that? Vietnam. So what happens is you're going to see basically China exporting its production to get around the tariffs to Vietnam. Then Vietnam then does something, doesn't have to be a lot, and then it ships it back over to the United States. So now you've got two things going on. If I was to cut off lithium batteries and just simply say to the American market, you can't have access to them, that's going to really hurt the American move towards electrification, because if you look at it, over 70% of our lithium, about 70% of our batteries come from China. Of that, maybe 2-3% come from Vietnam, and then the remainder comes from a mixture of other countries, including the United States. So that means we're going to be in a world of pain. Or then we have to look at each product coming in from another country to see whether or not China is basically transshipping products. Let me give you a prime example of how this game works. Alita Roth, who's now retired, she used to be at Clemson, described a situation where the United States and Europe do not allow vegetables to be grown in what's known as night soil, which is very common in China. If you've ever seen The Martian with
Matt Damon?
If you've ever seen that movie, Matt Damon, right? Remember how he grew potatoes using his own excrement?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. So what happened? The Chinese shipped the product to another country, and then the other country shipped it into Italy. And when people got into it, they found out, guess what? What you're seeing is the Chinese playing a game. And so you've got two problems. Number one, we depend upon certain items that they can say no. Number two, we have to deal with, are they moving products around? And then number three, while we're dependent on China, China's been more successful on diversifying its exports. It's no longer as dependent on the United States. So you've got this interesting game going on about how you respond. We need to do something in the United States. If we think electrification is the way to go, then we need to do something. We need to get companies to work together. We need to get an infrastructure in place. And we also have to understand that the Chinese have got volume now. Here's something to think about. Are you ready for this? In September of 2024, what percentage of cars in China were sold in China in that month were EVs? Take a guess.
100?
No, it was 54%. Think about that. In the United States, it's a small percentage. In China, it's a large percentage. There's this concept of volume. As you ramp up volume, you're able to drive down cost. What China has done in its industrial policy is basically gotten the Chinese marketplace to shift to EVs. Now you've got millions being sold, and what's happening is the cost of products are falling down. So, and guess who benefits from that? That cost reduction enables it to play the game of going into the United States and saying, we can competitively sell you a car for $35,000 and make a profit, whereas Ford has difficulty competitively selling a car for $55,000 and making a profit.
All right, let me move on here for a second. Let's say that for whatever reason, China can live with an 100% tariff, which would still make them competitive in the EV market, would it not?
Yeah, it could.
Okay, but wait, so let me keep going here. So that being the case, you can introduce a product, but you can't force anybody to buy it. And with that being said, that brings us to, infrastructure for EVs that brings us to places to have a car repaired, because, you know, it's one thing to buy a little gizmo or a gadget and not know where to have it fixed or make it disposable. Not the case with a $40,000 vehicle. So where would you have a Chinese EV repaired in the U.S.?
Well, that's an interesting situation. You've got one of two strategies. The first strategy is to build your infrastructure. The second strategy, you move into an alliance with a company, with an automaker, which has an existing infrastructure in place, and you partner with them. And if I was to look at that strategy, the company that comes to me as being the most likely partner would be Stellantis. Mm-hmm. Stellantis is struggling. It has a widespread infrastructure. Its products are considered overpriced. And so anything that Stellantis can do to drive down prices, and they're also, because they're primarily a European brand, even though they do have Chrysler and Jeep and Dodge, they have an infrastructure in the United States. So I can see two things happening. I can see basically the Chinese taking a book from companies like Honda, starting out small and then building their infrastructure out. The other thing I can start to see is they're trying to look for partnerships with companies which are struggling, and you have the ability, you've got cash, they don't, and seeing if you could get a situation where, guess what, we're going to work together, we're going to co-brand, I will sell my products under your brand, and therefore I can use your infrastructure to service my vehicles. But even then, you have to understand something. Most of the United States automotive market is also struggling with the issue of building a service network, not just for ICE, for internal combustion, but for EVs. You can't use the same structure for EVs as you use for ICE. And so you see the same problems being faced by companies like Ford, GM. So this is not a unique problem. But as I said, if I was to look at the Chinese, I'd see them starting off in California, developing a good structure there, and then branching out or else looking for a partnership.
Professor, real quick, I want to get this in before we run out of time, and that is comparisons to when the Datsuns and Toyotas first, I guess Hondas too, maybe first moved into the market. Are there comparisons to be made or not?
Oh, yeah. There are. One of the things that's going to happen is, the one thing that we have to understand, and the one thing that the Japanese learned very quickly, is what sells in Japan may not necessarily sell in the United States. When Toyota came into the United States, it found out that it developed a reputation as being a Rolls-Canardly. What's a Rolls-Canardly, you ask? During the Depression, there were cars which were known for being not able to get up the hills, but when they got to the top of the hills, they were able to roll down really nicely.
Wait, what was that, Professor? They were Rolls, what?
A Rolls-Canardly.
And that was made by whom?
That's the name that they gave to cars in the Depression, but it was applied to Toyota. Its cars were underpowered.
I got
its
you.
Its cars were underpowered.
Because they had a song. Didn't they have an oldie song about a Honda or something like that? They couldn't get up a hill?
That's right. And so what the Japanese learned very quickly, you've got to increase the power. And the other thing the Japanese learned, you've got to make the cars bigger. I don't know if you remember the first Honda Civic. It was a small thing. Mm-hmm. They've increased the size. The same thing is going to happen with the Chinese. The Chinese like gimmicks. I don't know if Americans do. So there's going to be a process where you bring in your product into the market, and then you learn what the market wants and doesn't want. And that's got to be done. Just because a car sells successfully in China with features. For example, in China, the BYD cars don't have any rear-view mirrors. Why? They've replaced them with cameras. Mm-hmm. That's not allowed in the States. So you're going to have a process of adjustment. And so as China comes into the United States, you're going to have them focusing on three things. Developing brand recognition. You want your product to be seen as well-priced, well-specced, and well-built. Secondly, you want to see about learning. What is it the American consumer wants? What don't they want? And the third thing is you're going to have to build an infrastructure. You're going to have to deal with the same challenges that Tesla did. Maybe use a Tesla model of branching out without dealers. But you're going to have to deal with this question of service, learning about the marketplace, and then building brand recognition. I can assure you that the first cars that the Chinese ship to the United States are going to be phenomenal quality.
Are Chinese cars coming to the U.S. now or not?
They're coming. A footprint's being established. If you take a look, you were looking online. Take a look. You can see that BYD now has an operation in California.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening is the Chinese are starting to come in. They're starting to put their footprint in. And what they're doing right now is they're bringing cars in and they're introducing their cars to car enthusiasts. And they're trying to show the American market that when you look at a Chinese car, it's not what you think. It's not poorly built. And if you read the reviews, I mean, take a look. You look at the Avatar 12. What was your impression of that car?
Futuristic, state of the art. I don't know. Different, new.
It was different. Did you find that
steering wheel shape was different? It did not look cheap. No.
No, and that's what they want to come across with. Remember, people are going to make their buying decisions based on the first units that come out. If those first units are a disaster, that kills the brand. So, if one thing I've learned about working with the Chinese and observing the Chinese is they play the long game really, really well. And, you know, they don't look at today. They look at down the road, yep, in the future. Yep. And that's the thing we have to deal with them. I don't like the Chinese, but I respect them enormously as competitors.
And I think people
never underestimate.
Go ahead, Professor.
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to agree with you totally in that. Don't ever underestimate the Chinese, and don't ever think that they're not looking half a century ahead. Accurate?
Yeah, it's basically they want to be the dominant. They want to replace the United States. They want to do to the United States what Henry Ford did in 1912 with his Model T. When basically, prior to Henry Ford, cars were something that only the rich could afford. Henry Ford's genius was he understood that cars are something everyone should have been able to afford, and he developed a product that people wanted, and the result of which was he developed an industry and developed essentially a brand. And the Chinese are going to look at it the same way. They see that if the future is electric, they're going to use their market to gain volume. And once they drive down prices, they're going to come into the United States market. They have come into Australia. I was in Australia for 2 years. I had a joint appointment with the University of Newcastle. Loved Australia. And I saw the Chinese cars there, and I got into them. They were well built. I could see why Holden's, which were the GM product, were on the downturn. The Chinese came in, offered a well-built product at a competitive price, and the customers liked it.
Professor, I can't thank you enough for your time. We're going to have you again in the next year, because I think this is an important conversation that we had about the Chinese and playing the long game and what response they could have to tariffs. And I think the other thing is, and we'll go into this next time, is that the American automakers or the other automakers are not necessarily maybe what's going to do and they're not going to do what's in their best long-term interest as much as prop up the stock price now, which I think is part of it, which, again, doesn't play well with the Chinese playing a long game. Thank you so much, Professor Stephen Melnick, Professor of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State.